Kirk Kerkorian's billion-dollar bad bet.
Kerkorian bought 100 million shares in March. He offered to buy 20 million shares in April. $8.50 a share is what he paid at that point. And now again, he's selling for $2.43 a share. So not a very good return on his investment here.
Oh my God. Slam, bam.
He's a 91-year-old with $700 million to lose. When Kirk Kerkorian bails out of Ford, what does it mean for the company's 200,000 workers? Nerves of steel or terminal cash bleed? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 22nd. So, John, was the oh my God for Kirk, or was it for the 200,000 workers who are dealing with this turmoil?
Yes, for the workers, for the whole industry. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning to you. And we're going to talk about, as you said, Ford's troubles and really what they mean to the rest of the economy along with your wallet. Plus, the World Series, well, it starts tonight, Phillies versus Rays. Or Pennsylvania versus Florida, depending on how you look at it. Who should presidential candidates root for when two swing states clash on the field? We'll look at sports and politics, but first we have some headlines.
Any diner worth his salt has a revolving display of scrumptious pies. Politicians do a lot of campaigning in diners, and the candidates seem to have pie on the face? No, the brain.
Senator Obama is more interested in controlling who gets your piece of the pie than he is in growing the pie.
It's John McCain in a pie fight over tax plans. Barack Obama tossed one at McCain.
After 8 years of Bush-McCain economics, the pie is shrinking. And what's left of the pie has been eaten by millionaires and billionaires.
I don't know what our news writer is smoking this morning, but both men are topping their economic pie. I'm reading here, harangues with meringue. We'll see if they serve up more pie today. McCain campaigns in New Hampshire. Boston cream would be regionally appropriate there. Barack Obama is in Virginia, where the South's famed chess pie is popular. I did not know that.
I'm going to bet that was Mark, but we'll talk about that after the show.
World
markets are open in Europe, and they're down sharply. Asian markets took an even bigger beating. Japan's Nikkei index led the slump. It closed down nearly 7%. Oil prices are sinking under the weight of all the bad economic news. It's been below $70 a barrel today. Traders believe the economic woes will reduce demand for crude.
And futures look pretty dismal. The S&P is down 2% in the futures market. A big factor in sagging markets, dismal news from key companies, Caterpillar, DuPont, and Sun Microsystems all reporting profit problems. Traders will be watching other earnings report due today. AT&T just put theirs out. Profits rose, but short of expectations.
The global finance crisis is plenty for banks to deal with now. Now, banks across America have gotten threatening letters full of white powder. The FBI says it does not appear to be anthrax.
They conduct a field test on the powder. So far, all negative. However, the substance is then sent to a regional lab for additional testing. We'll get the results in a couple days.
Even if the powder isn't deadly, hoax letters are... or sending a hoax letter is a serious crime.
As we said, futures trading point to a lower opening later this morning. We are America's exit poll because people are voting around the nation. And we'll have voices of voters later on in the program. But tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE at America's Exit Poll.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
With some gloomy earnings reports and market futures pointing due south this morning, a major investor has delivered a significant vote of no confidence to the auto industry. Wealthy financier Kirk Kerkorian began yesterday selling off a $1 billion investment in Ford stocks Trouble is, it's not worth $1 billion anymore. It's only worth about $300 million. He's bailing. What does it mean for the market? Yesterday, he announced that his Ford position is being unwound. The price he offered to sell his stake for is already way too high. Ford closed lower than Kirk Kerkorian was trying to sell his shares for yesterday and is poised to go lower again. Joining us from Detroit is Bill Vlasic, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Bill, this is a big shockwave for the automotive industry. How are they taking the news this morning?
Well, this city and this industry has been reeling for some time now, and this is just more bad news on top of bad news. Mr. Kerkorian has been a very interested in and supportive investor now of all three car companies at one time or another. But this time it appeared that he had very high hopes for Ford Motor Company and its management. And in 6 months' time, I don't care how rich you are, losing $700 million is quite a downer.
Even at age 91. Bill, you know, this seems to go right in line with the apparent sort of urgency on the part of Cerberus, the company that owns Chrysler, to unload Chrysler in some kind of GM-Chrysler merger. If all these so-called strategic investors are saying, we're done, this industry isn't going anywhere, what does that mean for the workers and the pension plan assets that these companies have?
Well, it's from the biggest investors to the smallest investors. People are fleeing these stocks. The stocks in GM and Ford have just gone to unthinkable lows, and it's only, again, a symptom of what's wrong with this industry right now. Sales are going down to the lowest point in 15 years. There looks to be no relief in sight, and the companies have been cutting furiously jobs and production to try and offset this to no avail. So the downward slide continues, and the liquidity and the cash positions of these companies are getting very, very tenuous.
So I guess it is a shrinking pie in the case of the auto industry. Seriously, though, if a company's stock loses 80% of its value, what does that make it more difficult for the company to do?
Well, in General Motors' case, and Ford as well, borrowing right now is very, very difficult. Their credit ratings are so low, they can't borrow at any type of interest rate that makes sense. So they're shut out of the debt market. They can't issue new stock because their stock price is so low, so they can't raise money that way. How they get funds to keep these operations going long enough for the market to recover is the big unknown right now.
And even at these low oil prices, selling cars is not the answer.
People are finding it, they're just not coming to the showrooms. Credit is hurting the consumer as well. The auto company's loan arms have tightened their credit standards to the point where you could be a great credit risk and still not get a loan. And so people are putting these purchases off, and it doesn't appear that that's going to loosen up soon. So it's like holding on to the mast as you sail into the hurricane situation.
Holding on to the mast. Is there any sort of reaction on the Ford stock to Kerkorian getting out? I mean, did certain investors come in and try to bolster things at the end of the session yesterday, or is everybody taking his cue?
Ford closed about $2.17, which was not their low. Their low last week was below $2. I would be surprised if there was any rush to come in. One thing about Kirk Kerkorian, he is somewhat of a bellwether investor. He has made a lot of money for people over the years who have just followed him into whatever investment he went into, kind of sort of the Vegas version of Warren Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
When he gets out, it's not a good sign.
Hey, Bill, Senator Carl Levin suggested that the automakers would go back to Capitol Hill to ask for money. What kind of plan could you envision the auto industry asking for, and do you think they'd be likely to get it, and would that save the day?
Well, Senator Levin is obviously a big booster of the industry here from Michigan, but there is definitely a growing sentiment that the car companies will return to Washington probably after the election to ask for perhaps another $25 billion in loans. As you recall, they received $25 billion specifically to meet fuel economy standards. But we believe it'll be more broad-based than that, that it'll be some sort of emergency short-term loan to boost our cash positions. How they're received, I think, will depend on who's going to be in the White House, and secondly, whether or not there's a feeling in Congress that this industry, with its hundreds of thousands of employees and dozens of plants and thousands of dealers, is as important as Wall Street was.
Well, certainly in human terms, the impact on the Main Street economy would be absolutely immediate. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Vlasic is Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, talking about Kirk Kerkorian's decision. I love that he called him the Vegas Warren Buffett, because he has so many holdings in MGM and a lot of the Vegas
properties.
A very
wealthy man is still going at 91, as you mentioned.
But he's pulling out of Ford, and that was the story with Bill Vlasic this morning. Adora?
John, joining us now is Brandon Wilburn with his story for America's Exit Poll. That would be the Takeaways America's Exit Poll. He, like Americans in more than 30 states, has had the chance to vote early. And well, Brandon, you did vote, right?
Yeah, correct.
You're in Guthrie, Oklahoma.
That's right.
Let's talk about your experience there. Were there long lines at the polling station?
Oh, no.
So how'd you do it? How did you vote?
It's definitely McCain.
But was it an absentee ballot, or did you?
Absentee, yes, ma'am.
And what motivated you to get your ballot in early?
Well, I've got commitments this coming next 2 weeks, so that's some of the reason why.
And how do you feel about the choices you had?
I feel good. I feel that McCain is definitely my pick.
You know, I have to say, Brandon, you weren't real convincing there when
No.
you said you feel good about your pick. I felt a little hesitation there. I felt a little kind of like, uh-oh.
No. During the primaries, I was a Huckabee supporter. Then once, the primaries were over with, McCain, he fits most of my views, not all of them, but most of them. And I feel very strong about, my vote. So,
what was the issue most important to you, Brandon?
There's a couple of issues that are at the top. First of all, I guess pro-choice and pro-life. I'm definitely a pro-life person. And McCain, he believes in that. And on the Democrat side, Obama doesn't. And the other issue that really sticks with me is our drilling. Here in Oklahoma, it's another oil boom down here. So then you have a president that comes in and he doesn't, believe in drilling. That's going to take away a lot of jobs that are in this part of the world.
Brandon, those are solid issues. And I also heard you say that you really feel strongly about your vote. But I just kind of ask you, when you look at these like kind of nutty Obama voters and they're jumping up and down and running around and all excited and everything, do you get a little twinge of jealousy that maybe the Republican Party didn't come up with something like that for you?
He
hung up. He hung up.
His supporters, like you said, they're some of them are kind of nutty, And
well, they're excited, man. They're screaming and yelling.
Yeah, they are. And he's a good talk. He's a good talk. You ask him a question, in the debates, and you'll say, okay. Do you support this or do you support that? And his answer is, well, I support both,
Oh, well, Brandon, thanks so very much for being with us. The spinmeister there, Brandon Wilburn, who is an early McCain voter from Guthrie, Oklahoma, part of the America's Exit Poll.
Yeah, but that kind of sounds like a politician, right?
He
you
does.
Ask
what
this
is,
and you ask that. And
what's he running? Yeah, that is true. Exactly. I mean, what's the surprise there?
Yeah. But he's made up his mind. He's voted.
And all the experiences of early voters are of interest to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. At Guantanamo Bay, it's beginning to look a lot like some sort of bizarre endgame. The government has dismissed all charges against five prisoners there after the military prosecutor assigned to the cases resigned. Joining us now is Jonathan Mahler, author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Jonathan, what is behind what looks like a gigantic government never mind to people who have been held for years at Guantanamo? Right. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
My pleasure. Well, I would say two things. One is it may very well not be a never mind. The government has dropped the charges, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to reinstitute new charges, and we can talk about that more in a minute. What's behind it, though the government has not acknowledged this, but what appears to be behind it and what almost everyone assumes is behind it is an affidavit by the former prosecutor for all five of these cases, who resigned recently, a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Daryl Vandeveld, who resigned basically under protest or was perhaps forced out because he was beginning to complain about the system, and specifically about the fact that the government was unwilling to share certain pieces of very relevant information with the defense.
Withholding evidence, he's not complaining about his parking space. He resigned over some basic juridical issue.
He's talking about sort of in specific discovery issues that the government wasn't sharing important discovery issues with the defense. And, I mean, these are things like the treatment of one of these detainees, and it's really one of these detainees in particular who is sort of the center of this, a guy named Mohammed Jawad. And this prosecutor, Vandeveld, discovered along the way that that Vandeveld may have been captured when he was underage, that he may have been basically duped into joining this radical organization that he was part of. They may have been drugged before he participated in the attack that he participated in, which was basically lobbing a grenade at a U.S. jeep in Afghanistan in Kabul in 2002. And that's just the beginning. He also discovered that that Jawad was essentially tortured as a detainee in U.S. custody, which the United States, of course, had not shared with the defense. So he felt that the system was essentially rigged, and that he couldn't really continue to prosecute these cases if the defense wasn't going to have a legitimate shot at defending these guys. So he resigned in protest, then agreed to actually testify on behalf of the defense, and in doing so, filled out an affidavit, about a 4-page affidavit, in which he kind of replayed some of these allegations. And in response to that, it would appear, because we don't know for sure, but it would appear that in response to that, the government decided to drop charges against Jawad and four other guys and kind of start from scratch, I guess you could say.
Jonathan, that story is stunning on about 10 different levels. But just to expand it, Vandeveld is not alone. Six military prosecutors have quit the Guantanamo court in the last 4 years.
That's right.
I find that particularly stunning because prosecutors tend to be incredibly dedicated, military prosecutors incredibly dedicated. For them to get to the point where they feel like they have no option but to resign is extraordinary.
No, it's incredible. I mean, that's right. He's the sixth. And in my book, I write about another one of these detainee cases, the Hamdan case, the only one that's actually gone to trial. And this is way back in 2005 when the first two prosecutors resigned. Back then, it was shocking because they were resigning really basically for similar reasons. And I write about it in the book. And now, while it's still shocking on one level, it's also become kind of almost a matter of course that these prosecutors just become disillusioned with this system, that all of them feel is unfair.
It says a lot for the sense of values of the prosecutorial talent there in the military. I mean, you know, I'm pretty cynical, and I watch TV shows about the law, and you know, I'm used to prosecutors being happy that the game is a little rigged in their favor. These are prosecutors resigning because they're likely to win their case based on the way the government is suppressing evidence.
Yeah, right. I mean, these guys, all these prosecutors come from the military trial system, the court-martial system, and all of them are officers, and all of them feel that they have a duty, you know, two duties, a duty as lawyers to you know, do their jobs honorably, and a duty as officers to sort of uphold the Constitution, and all six of them have felt that they've been unable to fulfill those duties given the kind of hand they were dealt by the government. So it's remarkable.
And Jonathan, what does this say about the overall Bush administration policy down there in Guantanamo Bay and the future of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, right now it's hard to draw any kind of long-term conclusions. I mean, you have this situation, which basically is the government leaving this in the lap of the next administration. I mean, it's very unlikely that charges are going to be refiled against any of these guys during the Bush administration. So that's going to be someone else's problem.
Yeah, indeed. Well, it's certainly a problem for us to think about in terms of the reputation of the military justice system in the United States. Jonathan Mahler, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Mahler is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and the Fight Over Presidential Power. And now back to America's Exit Poll.
If we want to stay militarily strong, we'll vote for McCain, and the economy will follow.
We got to have a change. We can't go on like we are. We could have four more years of George Bush.
Opinions from people around the nation who are voting. What's driving your early vote? Tell us your democracy experience at Democracy's Hotline, America's Exit Poll, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Oil prices fell below $70 a barrel today. That's despite a probable cut in production from the OPEC cartel. Investors may believe the economic slowdown here is severe enough to keep the demand for oil low. U.S. market futures are down a bit before the open. News moving the markets includes a number of poor third-quarter earnings, and among them Mukovia, which reported a nearly $24 billion loss, and that was even worse than expected. And the UK is well known for its boisterous political heckling. Prime Minister Gordon Brown was on the receiving end of it this morning in the House of Commons.
We must now take action on the global financial recession, which is likely to cause recession in America, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, and, because no country can insulate itself from it, Britain too. And that is why we are giving our undivided attention to helping families and businesses.
Not on a good reception to Prime Minister Gordon Brown talking about a likely recession in the UK and around the world. VP candidate Sarah Palin charged the state of Alaska thousands of dollars to bring her children with her on her government trips. And this is according to an Associated Press investigation. State law allows payment for travel for government officials on business, but it doesn't address payments for a governor's children. The McCain-Palin campaign says the governor acted legally in billing the state for her travel.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Here are some more voices from America's Exit Poll.
It feels pretty important, like my vote is going to matter.
What's driving you to vote this year? There are more than 30 states where Americans can cast their ballot. tell us your story, and you can call us on Democracy's hotline, or I should say our Democracy hotline, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So fall classic, do you think presidential election or do you think World Series? Well, for most of America's political history, either there was no World Series or it was over long before the election. Lately, though, with competition with the NFL, et cetera, the World Series has been creeping into late October and even early November. We have a new twist this year. The Tampa Bay Rays face off in Game 1 with the Philadelphia Phillies. Both teams are in swing states in this election. It's a political twist and a baseball twist. Game 1 begins tonight, by the way, and joining us is Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of The Note at abcnews.com. Rick, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
So all of a sudden, the Fall Classic in two swing states means that political rhetoric has to bend to the task of projecting allegiances appropriately. How are the candidates doing?
Well, you know, I think that you think by now they get the message that the biggest thing you want to do is consistency, and that is exactly been the problem so far with both Sarah Palin and Barack Obama. They've come out with and declared some sort of allegiance for multiple teams, which I think really is the cardinal sin of both fandom as well as politics. It opens one up to attacks, and we heard John McCain on the stump yesterday talk about this as a metaphor for his flip-flopping and saying, look, this is a guy that goes to Philadelphia and says he's a Phillies fan and then goes down to Tampa and says he's showing some love for the Rays. So,
well, Rick, let's hear John McCain going for blood on this baseball issue.
I heard, maybe you did too, that Senator Obama was showing some love to the Devil Rays down in Tampa Bay yesterday. I'm not dumb enough to get mixed up in a World Series between swing states. But I think I may have detected a little pattern with Senator Obama. It's pretty simple, really. When he's campaigning in Philadelphia, he roots for the Phillies. Then when he's campaigning in Tampa Bay, he shows love to the Rays.
Rick Klein, in the era of free agency, does that argument hold today?
Well, McCain should have started by getting the Rays name right. They're no longer the Devil Rays. That's mistake number one there.
Yeah, that was bad.
But I don't think many voters base their vote based on who's a fan of what team. I can't imagine that is what swings. It's an easy applause line if you're in a swing state to say, hey, I'm for the home team. It's almost too easy, I think, because it then tempts candidates to say multiple things in front of multiple audiences.
And candidates have done this in the past. I mean, Rudy Giuliani wearing a Red Sox hat when he was campaigning.
Yeah, and that was an image, I think, that was
a little terrifying to some of us in New York.
It wasn't terrifying, but it was just inauthentic. I think that's something you talk about, Rick, right? If you're going to be a fan,
yeah,
be a fan, but don't be an opportunistic fan.
I think that was a low moment for the Giuliani campaign. He may have thought he was getting himself New Hampshire votes. Obviously, it didn't work out that way. But he was one of the country's best-known Yankee fans. So to suddenly say you're rooting for the Red Sox just sounds like just utter pandering. Hillary Clinton, when she said that if the Yankees and the Cubs met in the World Series, she'd have to alternate sides, that seemed to be a stand-in for her indecisiveness or refusal to take firm positions while she was a front runner. And I think the problem that people have is the danger isn't in rooting for the wrong team. You know, people are fans of teams; they win and they lose, and it has nothing to do with the candidates. The danger is in being seen as either inconsistent or a flip-flopper or a panderer in some way. That's what gets wide news coverage. I've noticed it was on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer today, this flip-flop that we're supposed to flip-flop by Obama. The Daily Show did something on it last night. It's just such an easy story to tell for folks, particularly around the time of a World Series, that's where a candidate has to be careful. You just want to be consistent.
Although the profile of the World Series, particularly in the states where these are going to be held, perhaps the networks aren't thrilled that it's Philadelphia versus Tampa Bay, but certainly the campaigns have an opportunity here, and you already have Barack Obama attempting to use the series as a platform for a long political commercial that he's taken out that actually delays the game. But here we have Barack Obama trying to strategically position himself. Listen to this, Rick.
I said from the beginning that I am a unity candidate, bringing people together. So when you see a White Sox fan showing love to the Rays, and the Rays showing some love back, you know we're on to something right here.
Of course, the White Sox didn't make it to the World Series. They might have. They were actually in the postseason. But there were Rays that showed up at the Obama event there in Florida on October 20th.
Sure. and it reminds me of Kurt Schilling showing up at some of the events in New Hampshire for President Bush.
Some people said that was significant.
He didn't win New Hampshire,
no,
but
that's true.
It did seem significant at the time. It helped them build some large crowds, and there was a lot of excitement to see Kurt Schilling among folks. I remember talking to people at events then that they were much more excited to see a Red Sox hero than the President of the United States at the time. But all these candidates, they love to jump on to the excitement that's caused by sports, and that when a team is in the playoffs, obviously it would be a huge deal for either Philadelphia or Tampa Bay to win the World Series, because it's been so long in Philadelphia and it's never happened in Tampa.
But the bottom line here, Rick, as you say, it doesn't matter.
Well, wait a minute.
I don't think, again, the only reason it matters is if it allows you to be portrayed as inconsistent or a politician in some way.
Then does Barack Obama have a danger of being viewed as an opportunist by using the series to project his media buy here?
Yes, sure. And, you know, he had to clarify yesterday and say, hey, I never said I'm not rooting for the Phillies, which almost made it sound worse, because you listened to that soundbite you just played. Gosh, it sounded like he was a Tampa fan all of a sudden. But he is saying that his campaign manager, David Plouffe, is a diehard Phillies fan. And in fact, I was talking to some of his campaign folks a few weeks ago. They were actually afraid that the Phillies would make the World Series because David Plouffe is such a fan. They were sure they would get nothing done as long as Phillies games were on.
Well, for these candidates, it's like the fourth inning and they can't throw a strike and the bases are loaded with two outs, or maybe one out. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News and author of The Note at abcnews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we move to headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes past the hour. To the hour, excuse me. Markets in Europe are down this morning. The FTSE's down almost 4%. That follows losses in Asia this morning and in the US yesterday. Poor earnings reports are among the news pushing markets lower. North Korea wants Japan out of six-party nuclear talks. The country has refused to grant North Korea the aid it seeks as part of a previously negotiated agreement, and the US may also ask another country to provide aid in Japan's place. 2 months after the war in Georgia, Western donors are expected to pledge more than $3 billion to help rebuild the country. Some 70 countries and organizations are meeting in Brussels today. World Bank economist Sama Mitra explains why so much money is needed to help rebuild a country of less than 5 million people.
Many will be displaced for a long time to come. One has to look after their needs, their food security, their housing, and to build durable housing for them for the future.
The World Bank will be pledging $900 million and is hopeful that the United States and the European Commission will also make large donations to help rebuild Georgia. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Dora Udoji. It's official. Indians are officially a member of the Club of Countries Exploring Space.
All the authorizations are being given. All the parameters are in good shape. The vehicle is good health.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Plus one.
Yes.
Plus two.
The vehicle has lifted off.
The vehicle, a rocket carrying an unmanned satellite, lifted off from the Sriharikota Space Center in southern India. The satellite, Chandrayaan, which means lunar craft in Sanskrit, is scheduled to orbit the moon for 2 years. The mission is to study the moon's mineral composition. Sanjoy Munjumba joins us from the BBC from Delhi. Hi there, Sanjoy. Clearly a proud moment in Indian history. They are very proud. Let's listen to one of the officials speaking.
Our scientific community has once again done the country proud, and the entire nation salutes them.
That's Prime Minister Singh. What does this mean, Sanjoy?
Well, it means a great deal for a country that really thinks its moment has come. India is a country that's recently been given the status of a nuclear power by the United States. It's one of the world's emerging economies. It's got a space program that's fairly well developed. It's for several years now been able to send up satellites into space on board its own rockets. but it's never actually sent a satellite or any spacecraft, for that matter, beyond the Earth's atmosphere. So it's actually marking new territory. And at the same time, it's something that is developed entirely on its own, which is one reason why there's a tremendous sense of achievement here in India today.
And what are the goals of the mission itself?
Well, over the next 2 years, Chandrayaan, which is a lunar craft, will be placed in a lunar orbit. And what it'll actually do is actually map the surface of the moon. Now, when the Apollo missions and the Soviet missions were sent up in the 60s, they actually only studied a segment of the moon itself. And a large part of the moon, particularly the one that's not visible to us here on Earth, was never studied. And so what this mission is aiming to do is actually study the surface, create a three-dimensional atlas of the moon, so it'll actually map it in its entirety, and then look for the presence of water, because if the world is ever to colonize the moon and place some kind of a settlement there, you need water. So that's one of the many ambitions that this project has.
Now, this launch was actually shown on live television. Any sense of how many people watched?
Well, you can be sure that millions watched. It was very early in the morning, but it was live on state TV, which is carried across the country. And it's something that many people here in India had anticipated for weeks. There was a tremendous build-up in the media. People were talking about it. Yeah, there are a lot of people here who are questioning whether India should be spending the kind of money it is, $80 million on the mission. But by and large, there's a tremendous sense of pride and a feeling that this is a project which is justified.
Sanjoy Munjumber, thank you so much for your update. Munjumber reports from Delhi for the BBC. Big deal there for India, John.
I love that launch. All parameters are in good shape. It's better than the Texan kind of, we are go for lunch. All parameters are in good shape.
And what do you think the 0 plus 1 plus 2?
Well, the mission has started, so it's going up. Plus 1, plus 2.
I knew you'd know. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm a math major.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 22nd. Femi OK has the latest headlines for us. Femi.
Hello there. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Markets in Asia were all down this morning. The Nikkei took a big plunge, almost 7%. Oil prices fell below $70 a barrel today, and that's despite a probable cut in production from the OPEC cartel. The Department of Homeland Security will launch a new passenger screening program early next year. The long-delayed move replaces the current system, where people are sometimes mistaken for those on the terror watch list. Homeland Security says the new system will cut down the confusion. A wildfire in California's San Bernardino County is forcing people to run from their homes. Strong winds are pushing the fire west. Similar conditions fueled large fires last week. And Google's G1 phone is in stores today. The most talked about feature is how easy it is to use the internet on the go. It has a large touchscreen, a slide-out keyboard, Google email, etc., etc. Partnered up with T-Mobile, it will cost you a little less than the iPhone at $179. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you very much, Femi. We're building what we're calling America's exit poll, looking for people's experiences of early voting, since there are many states where people have been casting ballots. Here's one startling story of an early voter in West Virginia.
I voted straight ticket, Democrat. I pushed Obama and Biden. It immediately went up to McCain on the Republican ticket. And then we went down to the governor's race. And the same thing happened. We sat out there today and watched all them old people. Now, I'm 81, okay? And I get around pretty good. But we watched the old people going in. Some of them couldn't hardly walk up steps. Now, I just wonder how many of them went in there and pushed that button and that happened to them. And they walked away not knowing it.
That's Ripley, West Virginia, not the only place with early voting. More than 30 other states are taking votes, too. And it's a good thing some are starting early because there are reports already about machines that don't work, like that one in Ripley. But there's still time to fix them and get those votes counted. Joining us now is Scott Finn, the news director for West Virginia Public Broadcasting, who got that sound for us. So thank you, Scott, to talk about the problems that have popped up in his state. Also with us is Shakaya Andres, a reporter for the Times Union in Jacksonville, Florida, where there have been some issues, too. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott, let's start with you. In West Virginia, we're talking about electronic voting machines misreading votes. Tell us what happened and how it's being addressed.
Well, in two rural counties here, there have been 8 reports of voters saying that they have attempted to push the button for Democratic voters, and it has flipped to Democratic candidates, since flipped to Republican candidates. They made these reports to the largest paper in the state, the Charleston Gazette, over the last 2 days. Election officials here are starting to take this seriously. Not really, actually. It was interesting. At first, they tended to blame the voters for not knowing what they were doing or for not checking closely enough at the end of the experience to make sure that they had voted the way they wanted to. When voters were saying over and over again they were trying to touch Democratic candidate, and all of a sudden it would click up for a Republican candidate. And as the person that you spoke to earlier said, a lot of these people are older people. They're not really familiar that much with computers, and they get kind of worried when they try to touch Obama and it flips to McCain. And the response they were getting at first was just basically, well, we'll come over and we'll fix it. And that doesn't seem to be enough for a lot of people. And this is getting national attention. CNN was here yesterday, and I think that's finally getting election officials interested in trying to actually fix the problem instead of blame the voter.
And interestingly enough, Shakaya, we're going to Florida. Clearly, problems with casting votes brings back lots of memories to 2000. What happened there with machines rejecting ballots?
Well, good morning, first of all, and thanks for having me. First of all, we do not have the electronic machines like we had back in 2000. What we have are ballots, and people fill out their person of choice, who they want to elect as president or whoever their candidate is. And once people were going, filled out that form and tried to stick it in the machine would not take it. And the ballots were being placed in what was called an emergency bin on the side of the machine. And people felt a little uncomfortable that their ballots weren't being scanned in. And the ballots that were placed into the emergency bin were then counted later after the polling places were closed. So people felt uncomfortable that they did not physically
But is that according to election officials that those ballots were later counted?
Yes, that is according to election officials. Here in Florida, the community is also invited to come back to see those ballots being counted and rescanned.
How many voters are we talking about that ran into some troubles?
We're not sure of a number, but almost 12,000 people voted in Duval County on Monday.
And Scott, this is an interesting point that Shakaya just brought up that you speak about, which is this is a question really of trust, that voters are a little suspicious that somehow their vote is not going to count. And how are election officials dealing with that notion in West Virginia?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, even let's just assume that this is voter error, which is what they said the first time around, that older people in particular are having trouble pushing the right buttons, essentially. Even if that's the case, a lot of people are walking out of the ballot box and they're not feeling like their vote was properly recorded. And I think that that itself is a problem and a failure of the system. And it's unfortunate. In the blogosphere here, you have Republicans making accusations about voter fraud. You have Democrats now saying that Republicans are trying to steal the election, they say, again. And it's leaving a bad taste in people's mouth. And it really does taint the system. You would think that 8 years after Florida, we would have this fixed, but it seems to be not fixed at all.
Well, Scott, I mean, aside from the psychological factors of trust and, whether people are comfortable with the voting, I mean, even at this early stage where we have lots of people interested in early voting and the infrastructure breaks down in this way, I mean, that story from Calvin Thomas just was pretty riveting. I mean, it sort of says it all right there. I mean, what's going to happen on Election Day if this is happening in the kind of like open-ended, environment of early voting?
Well, and one more aspect in West Virginia, in the very recent past, there have been a lot of officials convicted of vote buying. I mean, I'm not talking 30, 40 years ago. I'm talking 5 years ago.
Nice.
$20 in whiskey, to be honest with you, is still enough to buy a vote in parts of the state. And so you combine that together, and the fear is that it's making people less likely to vote. We have a record registration here in West Virginia this year, like in a lot of states. And I think it's important for the media to get the word out there that there are problems. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you don't want to scare people and make them think that their vote won't count.
And Shakaya, what about, obviously, in Florida, it's a very sensitive subject, counting votes. How have election officials tried to address some of those exact issues that you've talked about, that Scott is talking about?
Well, yesterday, they received 10 more machines, and what they did was they tested all the machines to make sure that they were working, and they found the problem, is what they said. You know, and they blamed it on ballots being askew. And apparently, if the ballot, because we have our early election precincts, people can go to any branch, so they're having to print each ballot for each person or wherever a precinct they go. So because they're having to print it out, some of them were printing askew, and they weren't printed, you know, directly on it the way it needed to be. So that was causing the machine to kick back the ballot.
Shakaya, we're going to have to leave it there. Shakaya Andres, reporter for the Times Union in Jacksonville, Florida, and Scott Finn, news director, West Virginia Public Broadcast. We thank you both.
Stories of what it's like to be an early voter. Here at The Takeaway, we're conducting an exit poll of early voters because people are voting around the nation. Have you voted early? If you did, why did you want to? If not, why not?
I filled out an early absentee ballot, so I have already voted. And the reason I voted is I'm a musician and I'm going to be on tour, and I'll be in Arizona on Election Day and won't be able to vote in my home district.
What's your reason for early voting, and what's your experience of early voting? You can tell your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We are always on at The Takeaway. And before we go, I just want to point out markets are looking really much lower on the futures this morning. Wall Street will be open in about 30 minutes. And oil, in reaction to OPEC, is down $3.50 a barrel. Here's your takeaway.
And in 6 months' time, I don't care how rich you are, losing $700 million is quite a downer.
A downer, but not for Bill Vlasic, Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, who is speaking about financier Kirk Kerkorian, who was the one who sold off his $1 billion investment in Ford stocks. You can always join our conversation online. If you missed anything, you can catch up with us on iTunes. And
we have a good email from Ann Milligan who says, you know what, I mailed my ballot in last week because I wanted closure. I always vote the same way. That is, if the balance of power is going to be one party control, I will vote for the president who will make the difference.
You know, my wife wants to early vote. She wants it to be over.
She wants it to be over. Well, we just have days now, Allison.
Yeah,
Allison,
right?
Hockenberry.
Yeah.
Just a couple more days.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Priorities straight in the swing state.
Our nation's in a heck of a mess.
I like Palin really good.
And I think we need some good thought politicians that'll help the American people.
Oh, I would have liked to have been on Saturday Night Live with her.
In Colorado, they're voting early and very often, standing in lines to see if red becomes blue on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 22nd. Good morning, John. How are you feeling?
Good morning. Feeling pretty good. Pretty good. Lots of excitement about early voting, and we're trying to take advantage of it here on the Takeaway.
Yeah, we're trying to get below the numbers, right, to the real experiences, the individual experience.
Download democracy. Good morning, Adora.
Which is why we're going to be in the ground in Colorado and Oregon for a closer look at pivotal races there. Plus, the feds are using copyright law to take on an allegedly violent motorcycle gang. Very creative legal reasoning. We'll see if it works. First, these headlines, though.
Well, we've got a poll from the NBC News and the Wall Street Journal. It has Barack Obama with a double-digit lead over John McCain. We also have markets pointing downward, a 3% decline in the S&P futures in advance of the Wall Street Open. And a global leader across the pond is using the word recession with no hesitation.
We must now take action on the global financial recession, which is likely to cause recession in America, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, and because no country can insulate itself from it, Britain too. And that is why we are giving our undivided attention to helping families and businesses.
In the House of Commons, their recession is not an applause line. That's British Prime Minister Gordon Brown getting booed in the House of Commons just a few moments ago. He spoke as markets in the UK and elsewhere in Europe were down sharply today. Asian markets had it even worse. The Nikkei in Japan led the slump, closing down nearly 7%. And as we said, futures trading points to a down opening on Wall Street in just under a half an hour.
And oil prices are sinking under the weight of all the bad news. It dropped below $70 a barrel today. Traders, many of them, believing that the economic woes will reduce demand for crude.
It's at $68 a barrel right now. A big factor in sagging markets and oil prices, miserable corporate earnings reports. Wachovia, Merck, and Boeing all put out bad numbers in the last hour or so. All of those companies are indications of a broad recession. McDonald's bucked the trend, though. Its profits jumped 11%. Beating predictions.
I think that may be worth a story. Why McDonald's is flourishing while so many other companies are not.
Someone's loving it.
And as if the economic woes weren't bad enough for the banks, across the country, at least 30 letters were sent out to banks full of an unknown white powder. The FBI says at this point it does not appear to be anthrax.
They conduct a field test on the powder. So far, all negative. However, the substance is then sent to a regional lab for additional testing. We'll get the results in a couple days.
And it was in various states. A handful of states got the letters.
John McCain campaigns in New Hampshire, Barack Obama in Virginia. As we said, the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll shows a double-digit lead for Barack Obama in nationwide polling. Here at The Takeaway, we're conducting an exit poll of early voters all over the nation. If polls are open in your state, let us know who you chose and why. Tell us the experience of your early voting and the moment you knew you'd made up your mind. Democracy's hotline is 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
A very historic day, as we just said. Back in there, as soon as we walked out, we were very excited. We voted for the first black man in history and got our marriage license.
Who has the best tax plan, do you think?
Well, McCain. Obama's going to cost me more in taxes. I make over $250,000 a year. That's not what I take home. But Obama's going to cost more money to us.
Voices of people who have already cast a ballot in this presidential election, and they're in Colorado, where early voting has begun. It began on Monday. And Colorado this year could be a swing state. TAN Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein is there. Of course she's there. She's always where it's happening. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, Adora.
And so what are all these reports? There have been several in the last 24 hours about McCain giving up on Colorado.
Yeah, there have been some reports that he's pulling his ads here, that his aides are trying to find a path to victory without Colorado. But the McCain campaign is pushing back. They note that Sarah Palin has been here just in the Denver Post this morning. It was reported that McCain will be here Friday to make three stops. I still saw some ads on the TV here. And I got to say, yesterday when I was out talking to voters, it is clear to me that there are last-minute decision makers, Democrats, who cannot bring themselves to vote for Barack Obama, whether it's race, whether it's because they think he's too inexperienced, whether some of this other negative campaigning has seeped through. You know, we've talked about how when people go to pull the lever, something happens. And there are people who are deciding McCain at the last minute, like Richard Whitaker. He's a retired law enforcement officer in Pueblo, Colorado, where I was yesterday.
I'm impressed with Obama, but it kind of scares me. Couple of years in the Senate, and I just didn't feel like he had the experience. Plus, I'm a Vietnam veteran, so I kind of lean towards John McCain for that.
Do you usually vote Democrat, Republican?
I usually vote Democrat. I've been a registered Democrat all my life.
So that was in Pueblo, Colorado. You want to tell us a little bit about that county and why it might be important in deciding which way Colorado goes, red or blue?
Pueblo is a large county in southeastern Colorado, and it voted just slightly blue in the last two elections. But if you look at an electoral map, it has almost no color at all. It's one of those counties that gets pretty evenly split. It's unlike where I was yesterday, where there's a lot of new growth, natural gas coming in, high tech. This is an old steel town, and there's still some industry around it. Lots and lots of Latinos, some members of unions, although it's leaned slightly Democrat because there's almost a sort of connection with some areas in the Midwest and that it was an old steel town. There were lots and lots of McCain voters at early voting yesterday, lots of people going in to vote. One of the things is that we were in downtown Pueblo and we were at some early voting sites. And one of the things is that voters are giving you a sense of what this election might have been about had it not been the economy. Issues that are very important here in Colorado, like gun rights, have been eclipsed. Here is a voter named Christina Marquez. She says that she's an independent, and she's trying to puzzle out who she's going to vote for. Did you vote for President Bush?
I did.
And what do you think about the job he's done?
I think it could be a lot better. I am disappointed in my choice there. That's why I want to make sure that I really, really believe in my choice this time.
What do you think about the people that say, oh, McCain is Bush 3?
I would have to agree with some of that. Mm-hmm. I mean,
so how do you think you're going to decide in the end?
I'm probably going to vote for Obama because all in all, that's, other than the gun control issue, that's where I'm at with it.
That's amazing.
And another issue in Pueblo is during the primaries, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of reports on Latinos and how they felt about Barack Obama, that there was this tension in voting for an African-American candidate. What have you found there in Pueblo? Because doesn't it have a solid Latino community?
Well, you may remember yesterday I met the gentleman, John Gutierrez, who described himself as a brown redneck, very conservative, was not voting for Obama. But I met a lot more Latinos in Pueblo and in the area who were completely clear that they were voting for Obama. And one of the sets of people that came in was a family, Latino family. Gail Lopez came in with her daughter, Joanne, and they were determined to vote early this year. Do you usually vote early?
No, not usually.
No. What made you decide that this year you needed to?
I'm sure there's going to be a big turnout for the presidential campaign.
Did you make up your mind recently who you were going to vote for?
I made up my mind as soon as Hillary didn't win.
So what did you decide?
Obama.
No doubt in your mind?
No doubt.
When did you decide?
It's been a while, and plus my mom.
Oh, you're her
of the boss. No disagreeing with her. She's always right. And even if she ain't, she is.
And that's such an interesting social phenomenon because Latina women tend to decide who is voting in their families. And I saw that right in front of me, that they decide and then they bring the whole family and they all vote together. I did not find ambivalence about Obama. In fact, while I was in Pueblo, we went down and we checked out a livestock auction in neighboring Otero County. And I spoke to a rancher there named Andres Palestino Carreros. He owns a ranch and he was for Obama because he said he liked Obama's character and he thought he'd be better on immigration. And I asked him whether he knew about McCain's efforts to reform immigration. He said, oh, yes, I know all about that, but he's just too good friends with Bush. This conversation, by the way, was all in Spanish. And, you know, for Latinos here, I mean, there have been immigration raids up in Greeley where I was. You know, there's a big raid. Families have been broken up. This is a very real, visceral issue. And if there are issues of racism and social agenda with the Democrats, they are being eclipsed by these other things that are going on. By the way, while I was at the auction, I mean, I have to say that it was serious, serious McCain country. I mean, these were people who were voting for capitalism over socialism. Lots of ranchers. They were having lunch in between going out and buying cattle out in the auction. Here's Lloyd, who was one of the people who was expressing a very strong anti-Obama position.
In the cattle industry, you will lose money 6 years out of eight, and then the 2 years you actually make money, you will make very good money, and then have the government take that all away and give it to people who have no job and managerial skills is ridiculous to me.
That's what you feel, that's the Democrat agenda?
For the most part, yeah. Since 1931?
32, I guess it would be.
Yeah, and what an interesting snapshot, though, because so many are making the argument that the economy and the downturn in the economy is actually helping Obama, but here you have someone making an argument for why he's not voting for Obama, given what he believes is Obama's economic plans.
Right. I mean, these ranchers, one of them said, you know, I'm not putting a watermelon patch in the Rose Garden. There was all kinds of, ooh, you know, ooh, I don't like the company that he keeps, you know, and there was an incredible amount of, you know, Bush did a great job on the war. We think the war in Iraq, you know, Obama would have had to go in there. If Gore had been president, he would have had to go in there and fight that war after they bombed us, was what one person said to me. People said, look, if you're not there fighting that war and having a strong war, you're going to have a weak economy. I mean, you know, I was not too far from Kansas, which is a very, very red state, and you see some of these views kind of tilting over. However, at this auction,
well, hold on.
Before
you go there, I mean, it seems to me you've described just a couple of paths of people who retain
exactly
their loyalty to the Republicans.
Exactly, yeah.
But there are a variety of ways in which people are finding Barack Obama. That tape earlier of the woman who said, gun control, I don't agree with him on, but I'm still going to vote for Barack Obama. It seems like that is one of the reasons why Colorado is sort of in play right now.
Yes, that's true. Although, I mean, I do think that there is going to be a sort of a last-minute pullback. I mean, I know there's some polls showing that this is a 10-point race, but I think as people go into the polls, and it's so interesting because what I'm finding at the polls is people who voted for Obama seem to be much more willing to share the fact that they voted for Obama. Mm-hmm. There was a McCain supporter who didn't want to tell me who she voted for. Then finally she did, but she said, but we're going to lose anyway. So there's a sort of sense of beleaguerment or being, you know, back on their heels among the McCain supporters. But, you know, when I was down in Otero County, one woman was like, don't use my tape. They'll, you know, come and get me when she was
talking about
supporting Obama because she was saying that farm families are getting split up over the health care issue. They're having to move to town, one of the spouses, so that they can get health insurance and keep their farms. But at the auction, I actually met a Roosevelt Democrat. Jack, he was a rancher, and there was no question in his mind that he was going to vote Obama.
I wouldn't be sitting here today if it wasn't for Roosevelt and his New Deal. That's how my dad supported us, how he fed us. I'm almost 80 years old. I remember the Depression. I remember the tough times. I remember when we didn't have shoes to wear. That's the reason I'm a Democrat.
Great stuff, Andrea.
I know. Amazing sound. Andrea Bernstein, our takeaway political director, thank you so much. And we're going to keep you out there on the road.
Thank you. Such a variety of views in Colorado.
He remembers the Depression.
Well, you would if you lived through it, I think.
I mean, that's just such an interesting, no question in his mind.
Yeah.
Absolutely simple.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I voted in Florida by absentee ballot. The suggested postage on my envelope was $1, and my husband's envelope was $1.17. It was $1.17, so my envelope would have come back and my vote would not have counted in Florida. I think there's going to be another problem down there.
America's exit poll is open. We want to hear from anyone who's voted. Are you in one of those states that has early voting? And if so, what was your experience? How did it go? Call us at Democracy's Hotline, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
And have you seen problems in early voting? According to preliminary data just being reported on the New York Times website right now, more Democrats than Republicans have cast early ballots in Iowa, North Carolina, New Mexico, and Ohio. That's according to New York Times analyzed data. It's split in Colorado, but that bucks the trend. Republicans are typically
the
greater
ones who,
turnout,
yes,
great, ones who vote early. Oregon is also a vote-by-mail state where the polls are open, and there's a surprisingly tight race there for the Senate that could suggest some more general trends around the nation. To talk about the Oregon Senate race, we turn to Chris Lehman. He's a political correspondent for Northwest News Network. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Good to be here.
Now, this is a pretty solid incumbent, you would think, and yet this race is going down to the wire.
That's right. Gordon Smith is looking for his third term in office. And you're right, it is coming down to the wire. The two are in a statistical dead heat in the polls. And a lot of people think it's because Gordon Smith is a Republican. He's been trying to move, you know, even more towards the center than he has been over the years. Most notably, he came out against the Iraq War during a speech on the Senate floor. And he's been playing up his connections to Democrats in the Senate. You see names like Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton in some of his ads and press releases. And you know, this might appeal to more Democrats, but it's also ruffling the feathers of his Republican base.
And in the state of Oregon, you know, the land of Wayne Morse and, you know, Mark Hatfield, it is tough to be a Republican. There's a certain kind of counterintuitive window in there, and the Bush administration's difficulties seems to have created an opportunity for Jeff Merkley. Let's listen to the ads, because even despite what you're saying in terms of the Republicans being a kind of elephant in the room this year, there's still a sense of desperation in this race. First, we're going to hear a Jeff Merkley ad, and then we're going to hear a Gordon Smith ad. And I want your evaluation of the sense of desperation I'm hearing in these commercials.
I think I have a problem with Gordon Smith. He paid $1.2 million for a set of golf clubs. I worry about paying for groceries. He voted for over $18 billion in tax breaks to big oil. I worry about filling my tank. He even voted to privatize Social Security. I worry if I'll ever be able to retire. This relationship with Gordon Smith, it just isn't working for me.
I was just 13 when he broke into our house, attacked and raped me. Later, he confessed to raping eight others, but Oregon's time limit for prosecuting those rapes ran out. Jeff Merkley voted against changing the law. That's wrong, and that's why I'm speaking out. Jeff Merkley, you should have voted to protect victims, not rapists.
I'm Gordon Smith, and I approve this ad.
Wow. I mean, you've got serial rapists and million-dollar golf clubs in play there, and also the Democratic Senatorial Committee supporting Merkley pretty powerfully there, and Gordon Smith feeling a little on his own.
Well, yeah, I mean, the National Republicans have put some money into the race, but from all accounts, not nearly to the extent that the National Democrats have. I mean, they've poured millions and millions of dollars into ads supporting Jeff Merkley. And there you hear, I mean, that ad in support of Merkley there is really hitting all of the main buttons of the campaign this year. You know, they're saying Gordon Smith is wealthy, out of touch, and, you know, just gives away money to big oil and that kind of thing. I mean, obviously the truth is a little bit more nuanced than that. And then you have Gordon Smith trying to portray Jeff Merkley as being soft on crime. I mean, Oregon is a fairly left-leaning state, but even in areas that are left-leaning, people are worried about their personal safety. So that's something where Gordon Smith evidently felt he had an edge in that, you know, that's one of the few things Republicans can still safely talk about is, you know, we're tough on crime.
I wonder what voters are going to make of that in Oregon, though. It feels like a kind of a Willie Horton ad, only, you know, with a woman in the lead part there.
Well, one thing that doesn't really come across in that ad without seeing it is, I mean, that was a case that was very well known, and you know, the woman speaking there has been, you know, in the media a lot over the years, and it was a very famous crime in the Portland area. And, you know, this was something that the Gordon Smith, you know, researchers, I guess, combed through every vote that Jeff Merkley ever took in the Oregon legislature, and they found one that they really thought they could hit him hard on. And, you know, that's been a month ago, and I would point out there's probably been about 36 ads, you know, airing since then on both sides. So,
But Chris, clearly a very powerful message in that ad. Is it true? Is it that the whole truth, that he specifically voted against a law that would extend the potential for prosecuting rapists?
Well, he, it is true, but it's also, you know, he had some very specific reasons for making that vote, which, you know, he explained at the time. And, you know, in a state legislature, there's all sorts of political undercurrents going on. And, you know, it was a case where his vote did not make the difference, you know, as far as whether that would pass or not. So, you know, he felt, that was the right thing for him to do at the time.
Chris, before we go, I just want to ask you one quick question. It's mail voting, and, you know, you vote by mail in Oregon, which means that the polls are open, correct?
That's right. In fact, my ballot showed up in my mailbox on Saturday, so theoretically I could have voted already.
Any early signs that people have made up their mind and are getting their ballots in, and is that any indication of how this race is going to turn out?
No, in fact, there's really no indication yet how quickly the ballots are coming back. They'll start posting those numbers here in a day or two. So I don't, you know, but traditionally the vast majority of people wait until the last couple of days to vote here.
Well, interesting. Oregon could be a bellwether not only for the Republicans in the Senate, but also the impact of early voting nationwide. Chris Lehman, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Chris Lehman is a correspondent for Northwest News Network, reporting from Salem, Oregon, on the tight race in that state. And now headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. Just glancing at the futures for the markets. Wall Street just opens in a minute or so's time. Futures trading points to a lower opening. And it's been a rocky couple of days for Wall Street. Poor third quarter reports just out this morning. They won't help either. There's bad news for several companies, including Wachovia, Boeing, Merck and Yahoo. And in the UK, Prime Minister Gordon Brown says the economic crisis could cause a recession in Britain. And at the moment, the UK's main stock index is down to around about 3.5%. And some 3 million American children have food allergies, and the number is going up. That's a quick look at some headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
And today, Republican Senator Ted Stevens' political future, well, it's in the hands of a jury deliberating criminal charges against him, charges that he took $250,000 worth of gifts, including a sled dog, a sculpture, and a massage chair, among other things, that he failed to disclose. If Stevens is acquitted, that could mean one thing. If he's convicted, another. Though having said that, he's not the first sitting senator in this predicament. Capital News Connections' Todd Zwillick is on the line from Washington to take a look at the big picture here. And good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning. Good morning.
And what did you learn about what's happened to other senators who have found themselves in this position?
Well, I've got a little bit of trivia for you, Adora. How many sitting senators throughout history have been indicted?
I would guess.
Take a guess.
A dozen.
Not bad. The answer is 11. So you're about as close as you can get without going over. This tradition.
Whoa, do I get a car?
I want to buy a vowel. Yeah.
If you get a car, make sure you disclose it. That's my advice to you. Let's go back to 1808, almost exactly 200 years ago. Ohio Senator John Smith indicted on charges of treason. John Smith had a lucrative trading business, and Aaron Burr was moving weapons and men down in Florida. And Thomas Jefferson sent John Smith down there to try to head things off. Wound up that he got mixed up and was accused of trying to help Burr move weapons to invade Mexico. He got charged with treason. He was ultimately acquitted, but when he came back to Washington at that time, state legislators sent senators to the Capitol, not the electorate, and eventually the Ohio legislature asked him to resign because his name was basically ruined and he lost his career, even though he was acquitted. So, Senator Stevenson.
That's just one example. But you said, you asked me how many had been indicted, right? How many
Correct.
Have actually been convicted, and then what happened to them?
Only four in history have been convicted. Now, there have been other convictions, but there aren't a lot of examples to go on, but the tradition that seems to have developed around this is that if a senator is convicted, they almost always appeal and take their cases to the full extent of the law. And you can see that with good reason, because people want to protect their careers. Only in four cases have senators been convicted and had those charges stick through all of their appeals. And in all of those cases, they wind up leaving the Senate either through resignation or expulsion. We got another example, the most recent example, 1981. Senator Harrison Pete Williams of New Jersey, he was convicted in the Abscam bribery scandal in 1980, and his appeals went all the way to the Supreme Court. And eventually they refused his appeal in 1981. Now, he didn't leave the Senate until 1982, because the Senate then began expulsion proceedings against him. Even when he was convicted, he didn't resign, and it took the Senate to be on the verge of an expulsion vote before he resigned.
And I remember that case. I mean, there was a smoking gun in that case. There was this ugly video and film of him actually taking bribes.
From an FBI agent
That's
posing
right.
as an intermediary for Sheikh Rahman.
That was very amazing. But it still, the due process kept him in office for a very long time until expulsion proceedings were started. So what does that mean for Ted Stevens?
Well, I talked to the Senate historians a little bit about this week to try to get some historical perspective. And what they said was the Senate resists as much as they can taking disciplinary action against one of their own, any senator, especially someone as senior as Ted Stevens. What they prefer to do is let the courts mete out the punishment and let the voters mete out the punishment. So in Stevens' case, the Senate might be breathing a sigh of relief if he's convicted. Now, this is a lot of ifs. If he's convicted, it's right before his election. The most likely scenario is that the voters in Alaska will get rid of him, and the Senate won't have to do anything about it because off he goes. If he's acquitted and he's defeated, it's also not a problem for the Senate, obviously. And if he's acquitted and he wins his reelection, well, he's exonerated, so that's not a problem. So the big what if is, what if Ted Stevens is exonerated, wins his election? Pardon me, let's go back. I'm confusing myself. What if Ted Stevens is convicted,
right,
wins his election, and then, like most senators do, appeals his case, and after his election, things come to a head?
Todd, what's curious to me about that is I had been laboring under the impression that if you are a convicted felon, you cannot serve as a U.S. senator. If you are a convicted felon, I don't think you can run for president. Why can you be a convicted felon and serve as a U.S. senator.
It's the land of the free. What do you
by, by tradition, you cannot serve as a U.S. senator if you're a convicted felon. It's not in the rules.
Wow.
They're very they're looser than you think about this. Now, yes, it's true. They protect the integrity of their institution, and they get rid of senators who are convicted. But sometimes it takes a while.
Well, then who is this summation for today? Is it for the jury in the courtroom, or is it for the jury of 600,000 voters or whatever it is, 200,000, 300,000 voters in Alaska?
Yeah, well, it's for both, clearly. I mean, his Senator Stevens' political career, as well as potentially his freedom, hang in the balance. Legal experts don't think he would ever go to prison for this, but who knows?
What are the polls looking like in Alaska? How are the voters there feeling about him? I mean, things have turned out to be a little tighter than he would have ever anticipated, right?
Very, very tight. He's a little bit behind, but it's most polls have it within the margin of error. But that's remarkable when you look at a seven-term senator, the most senior Republican in the history of the United States Senate. He was fighting for his life in this race before he was charged. This whole case has been ongoing. He was tangentially connected to it. It was in the news. But this was a close race before he was charged. And now that he is, it's a close one. He's a shade behind right now.
Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. Thank you. Headlines now from Femioke.
Thank you very much. The time coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Market's been open just about 10 minutes now. The Dow is down over 100 points. S&P
over
down
259
points. It just dropped between, I clicked between my script and the markets. Thanks, John. And I had the S&P down about 2%. Is that still right?
3%.
Thank you very much. Meanwhile, it's been a poor day for European markets so far. Asian markets closed down. Economic woes aside, Western donors are expected to pledge more than $3 billion to help rebuild the country of Georgia. More than 70 countries and organizations are meeting in Brussels today to talk aid, and some 65,000 refugees lost their homes during its August war with Russia. The U.S. military says that it may have mistakenly killed 9 Afghan soldiers in eastern Afghanistan today. They believe that both U.S. and Afghan forces mistook each other. And elsewhere in the southern part of Afghanistan, 35 Taliban soldiers are dead after a two-day battle.
Some earnings reports, Travelers Insurance profits down more than 80% because of storms.
Wow.
And the tech company EMC, data storage company, says its net income dropped 17%. That's one of a number of earnings reports.
A miserable start to the economic day so far for us. I'll have some more news for you in 10 minutes' time.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us now from KPCC Radio, our affiliate in Southern California in the Los Angeles area, in Pasadena, actually, to be correct, is Brian Watt. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
We wanted to talk about this interesting story that has broken in your neck of the woods about the motorcycle gang, the Mongols. There was a mass arrest of the gang, of members of the gang yesterday, but there was a particularly interesting twist to the case. First, tell us about the arrest and the gang, and then we'll get to the twist.
Well, they arrested 61 members of the Mongols, which is this motorcycle gang that started back in the 70s here in the Southern California area. This a very, very violent, law-breaking group of motorcycle riders. So they take down about 61 members of the gang. I think there are over 600 members nationwide, most of whom, 400, are here in Southern California. So yesterday was the big arrest in California. I think they executed 160-some search warrants in states, all the way Ohio, Florida. I know they also have a chapter in New York. And so this was a major, major takedown, and they blocked off a street in downtown Los Angeles to display some of the 70 motorcycles that they seized and some of the more than 70 weapons that were seized from this gang. also a very, very massive collaboration between federal authorities with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, as well as law enforcement here in Los Angeles County.
So, Brian, the Mongols were formed a while ago as a competitor to the more famous Hells Angels. They were founded by a group of Latinos who had been rejected from the Hells Angels. They're known for their secrecy, their violence, and they're also known for a particular logo, which is at the center of the federal case. The U.S. attorney wants to actually take ownership of the logo. It's an almost an intellectual property case as well as a felony racketeering case. How does this work?
Well, that's right. U.S. Attorney Tom O'Brien said this is unprecedented, that this is sort of intellectual property history where, you know, the feds essentially want to, they filed a court order that basically asks for the gang or demands the gang forfeit its trademark. They've got this patch and this logo. It's this really scary-looking sort of, well, Mongol-looking figure with a ponytail riding a bike. And they trademarked that. The gang owns the trademark. The feds want them to forfeit it. And in the words of U.S. Attorney Tom O'Brien, if they can get that court order, then any law enforcement officer who sees a Mongol wearing his patch is authorized to stop that gang member and literally take the jacket that bears the patch right off his back.
Forget the jacket. Some members have tattooed the logo on themselves as a celebration or a badge of honor for committing violent acts. So it might be more difficult than simply taking off a jacket.
You're absolutely right. I mean, one of the reporters there actually raised, you know, a serious constitutional right to keep the trademark. And, yeah, I mean, once it is tattooed on someone's head because they committed two murders, which is something that is known to have happened.
The head becomes evidence in court. Brian, we have to go, but that's a really fascinating case. We'll talk to you again. Brian Watt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Watt's a reporter for KPC Radio in Pasadena about the Mongols case and the confiscation of a logo.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 22nd, and wow, the Dow's down 240. Femi Okay's here with more headlines of the hour.
Thank you very much. Time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. And Adora, investors are probably watching the miserable corporate earnings reports. Wachovia, Merck and Boeing all put out bad numbers in the last hour or so. ConocoPhillips is doing fine, though. The company reports a 41% rise as oil prices rocketed this summer. Just getting news in from the Associated Press about Pakistan, and the country has asked the International Monetary Fund for help to avoid defaulting on its debt. High oil prices and dwindling investment from overseas have triggered a balance of payment crisis that is undermining the Pakistani rupee. The IMF hasn't confirmed yet how much money it will give to Pakistan. Tampa Bay is in the World Series for the first time ever. They will host the Philadelphia Phillies in Game 1 tonight. And people with STDs can now let their partners know about them via the web. The website InSpot sends anonymous e-cards on a user's behalf, letting people know the bad news. More than 15 million STDs occur in the US every year, and the move is to try and cut down that number. Not exactly a Hallmark card moment, but it could help.
Would people do that inappropriately? Like, that's a prank?
This is the downside of it.
Yeah.
You thought ahead of that. Unfortunately, some people have been pranking people, so please don't do that, boys and girls.
I wasn't going to.
Why would you think of that first?
I'm a news guy. You know. Come on, we got to go for that sort of stuff. All right. Trouble in the headlines. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
But there's also trouble on Main Street.
The bankers inside here are responsible for the crisis. They're getting rewarded while the people who are the victims of this crisis are being punished by losing the places that they have to live.
Just off Main Street in America, it's Mortgage Holders Lane. That's where people are really feeling the pain from this financial crisis. And we wanted to check in with our friend and New York Times columnist David Leonard, who writes for the paper's Economix blog about what the predicament of mortgage holders is. David, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, as always, John.
And let's deconstruct the category of people who are mortgage holders or tentative mortgage holders. Who's most vulnerable, and who has the federal government offered, at least in theory, a helping hand to?
And I think that's right. That's really important to distinguish between, you use the plural categories, and there really are two main categories, and I think we often lose sight of that. So the first category of homeowners who are in trouble are people who are going to have trouble making their mortgage payments. And maybe they took out a mortgage that they were never, ever able to be able to afford. Maybe they took out one of these adjustable rate mortgages that has a balloon payment, and they're not going to be able to afford that. Or maybe when they took out their mortgage, they could afford it, but since then they've lost their job or lost some significant number of hours on their job. That's the first category. Those people literally can't stay in their homes in that they can't make their payments without some sort of adjustment. The second category is a little different. It's people who can make their monthly payments but are underwater in the language of housing, which means that their house has fallen by so much in value that it's now worth less than their mortgage. They can stay in their houses. Many of them will. Their kids like the schools. They like their neighborhoods. But some number of them won't, because they look at their house more as an investment than as a place to live, and they'll say, wait a second, I'm making monthly payments on an investment that's never going to pay off. And as we think about how to rescue homeowners, which seems to be in the air right now, I think it's important to keep those two groups separate in our minds.
Well, as an economist, as someone who writes about these kinds of programs, then you have Senator McCain talking about an additional mortgage bailout plan from the federal government should he be elected president. Which group is more deserving, in your view, of federal assistance?
Well, I would say, to me, the first group is certainly more deserving. I mean, people who are able to stay in their homes but may choose to leave because they don't like the returns they're getting, there's a word for that, and it's a speculator. It's not traditionally what we think of as a speculator, but that's really what people are doing. Now, I realize there are exceptions. I mean, if you imagine someone who had to move in order to be with a sick relative, they wouldn't be a speculator. And if they couldn't sell their house because they were underwater, that'd be a significant problem and hardship. The real issue we face with coming up with some kind of homeowner bailout, I mean, you often hear it's time to help Main Street. It's nearly impossible to solve the foreclosure problem and prevent all these foreclosures without ending up helping huge numbers of people who don't need help. Because if you think about it, if you're one of those homeowners who can stay in your home and is going to, and I'm one of those ones who looks at my underwater mortgage and says, I'm out of here, as soon as the government comes to give me help, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to say, actually, I'm also one of those people who's going to leave my home.
But David, isn't that a greater good argument? Because, I mean, the bottom line is we're spending billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars on helping to study the banking industry, and there are lots of executives who are still going to benefit from that.
Absolutely. I think there are two things here. I mean, your point is basically, look, we're kind of beyond the point where we're drawing fine moral distinctions about who deserves help and who doesn't. We're trying to do things to prop up the economy, and if some homeowners get help who maybe don't deserve it so much, then they probably deserve it more than Wall Street does. I get that argument. The problem is there are also a lot of people who deserve it even more than those homeowners, and I'm wondering why we're not helping them.
Like the people in the auto industry, who, if Kirk Kerkorian is pulled out of Ford, may lose their jobs if the auto industry sort of goes away. Well, as far as the moral distinctions are concerned, though, Dora yesterday spoke with the economic advisor to the McCain campaign, and he made this argument that we're going to be able to sort out the difference between people who lied on their mortgages and who didn't, the sort of 10 million mortgage holders who are in trouble, and help the ones who are honest and not help the ones who were dishonest. But isn't that sort of a complete distortion of the problem? I mean, it's conceivable that every one of the 10 million lied to get their mortgage. That's the problem here.
Well, I didn't hear the interview, but to me, it's right. It's not just that it's going to be hard to figure out who lied. It's also that some people told the truth but had fabulously unrealistic expectations because banks were giving out loans to people who, even if they told the truth, weren't going to be able to afford their mortgage. And people were saying, oh, but it's not a problem because my house is going to go up so much in value that even if I don't come into some windfall or get a raise, I'll be able to just sell my house and make a profit. So I agree. There's no easy way to sort through the worthy and the unworthy. We're going to have to help some number of people who maybe aren't unworthy. But I think we're going to have to also stop short of helping everyone who's worthy, because doing that would end up being massively expensive. And it's not clear to me that homeowners should necessarily be first in line above, say, someone who rents and loses their job.
Finally, you write, and for the Sunday Magazine this week, you write about people who have had a certain level of assumptions in their retirement strategies, one of which you've already mentioned, and that is that my house's value is going to rise forever and ever and ever. And all of a sudden, those assumptions have gone by the wayside. What others besides my house will always increase in value are suddenly looking a little ridiculous now?
Well, my favorite is the savings rate. I mean, the savings rate in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s was 9%. It meant we put away 9 cents on every dollar we earned. It fell to 5% in the 90s, and it's basically fallen to zero in the last few years. And that's sort of this assumption that, oh, I don't need to save money because the money I've already saved will do so wonderfully well. That's not the only thing going on. It's also an issue of the fact that income growth has been so slow, makes it harder for people to save. But you can't really survive as a society for any long period of time with a savings rate of 1%, which is what we've had in the current decade. And to me, that's something that's going to have to change.
Again, it's about speculators versus savers.
1%. Well, just very quickly before we got to go, but you said others should be helped, perhaps the person who loses their job and is renting. But is it a moral question, David? Or are we really talking about an economic functionality question? And which dollar is going to be better spent in getting consumers to have more money in their pocket to go out and spend and get this economy going?
I think help to a homeowner or to an unemployed renter both of those forms of help would have some economic benefit. So I do think it's okay to keep in mind not only the economic punch of the stimulus, but also who is deserving of stimulus and who really needs it. To me, people who are in their homes and can afford their mortgage payments, but may be upset about the fact they're underwater, would be behind in line people who can't make their mortgage payments or people who lose their jobs through no fault of their own.
Stimulus, morality, and getting the economy moving again. Interesting issues. David Leonhardt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As the S&P 500 shows a more than 3% decline on Wall Street, we say goodbye to New York Times columnist David Leonhardt, who writes for the Economics blog. He spoke with us from D.C.
And, John, we're always on The Takeaway. Did you know that?
I do know that, actually.
And we are conducting what? America's exit poll, right?
Exit poll, because Americans are voting now.
And what is America's exit poll?
Well, America's exit poll is basically we are polling actual early voters in states all around the nation in critical races. And we've already reported that the New York Times, according to preliminary data, shows that Democrats are voting in greater numbers in these early voting states, which could be a bellwether for the entire election. Early voters are important, and we want to hear from all of them at 877-8-MONEY-TICK.
Here's your takeaway.
Farm families are getting split up over the health care issue. They're having to move to town, one of the spouses, so that they can get health insurance and keep their farms.
That's Takeaway Political Director Andrea Bernstein talking to ranchers in the swing state of Colorado. And if you missed anything, it's all on our website. It's free at thetakeaway.org, and you can also get our podcast to go every morning on iTunes.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.